podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Again, they've only got three forwards in the line-out, and it's been left to Chris Wyatt, and how well he did that again. Scott Quinnell, a bust by Scott Gibbs. Scott Gibbs is through. Scott Gibbs has scored. What an amazing...
Welcome to this week's Attacking Scrum podcast. It's just me and the mighty Murph and his can of San Miguel, which...
Especial.
I'm sure Murph as well is a little tip of the cap to Spain qualifying for the Rugby World Cup today with a win over Portugal.
Yeah, totally not deliberate, but I'll take it.
Yeah. It could have been anything. There's Sagres in the fridge as well if Portugal had won. All eventualities covered.
Yeah.
Is that Portuguese, is Sagres?
Sagres is, yeah.
I did not know that. Yeah, good shout.
Sagres and Super
But
Bowl,
no, I didn't have Portuguese that. I didn't have that stocked up. I just had my usual tipple. So it's lucky Spain won.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of that game actually. But a big for Spain. They haven't qualified for a World Cup since 1999, I think. And by all accounts, it was a sellout as well, which is, you know, I don't know. You know, obviously, there's a lot riding on one game, but it's good to see Tier 2 nations able to generate interest in the sport. That can only be a good thing.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, I imagine when they last qualified, I can't imagine they had a big crowd in there that time. So, maybe they did, I don't know. But
yeah.
It's one of those where the Tier 1 nations don't really look after these small nations well enough. I know it's difficult, but... It's all about the bottom line, but some sides should go and play against them and try and get them involved, you know?
Yeah, well, exactly. We're only 2 minutes into the podcast, and we better not go down the route of all the ills of of Tier 1 and Tier 2 rugby. We'll, I'm sure, have time to delve into that at some point over the remainder of the season, as we always do. But Six Nations will dominate proceedings for this podcast. A near miss for Wales on Friday night, a win for Scotland away in Italy, and a really interesting game at Twickenham as well. So we get stuck into all of that, and we've got a load of listeners' questions as well to get our teeth into. So let's start by getting your thoughts on Friday night's game, Murph. What was your assessment of Wales' performance?
Well, generally around the media and various places, people seem to be quite positive because we pushed the French close and everything else. But personally, I just saw a side who were happy for us to have the ball because they didn't feel under threat at any stage, and we didn't really look like scoring a try, even though we dominated the second half possession wise and territory wise and whatever. And they just, I don't know what their motivation was, but they just seemed to shut up shop and soak up the pressure, and kind of I suppose the compliment from our point of view is because they would have been looking to soak up pressure and play on the break or play on the turnover. We didn't give them any opportunities in that regard, but I don't think they were ever really, aside from the Jonathan Davis knock on, which I think there was cover for anyway, even if he hadn't knocked it on, they were never really stretched much. So yes, we weren't as bad as we were against Ireland, but I'm not as you know, positive about it as most other people seem to be.
Yeah, I mean, I've, as you know, and obviously we've covered on this a number of times, I've been a bit, yeah, still, I'm still yet to be won over by the current regime and see where we're heading and what our kind of game plan is, and you know, and how we're going to fare in the absolute biggest games. What I will say is, you know, that was to run France that close, I think, Take some doing, because they are a hell of a side. And I do think, you know, as you know, I'm a fan of throwing in a sporting analogy. I do think there was points in there that France were rattled. I know what you're saying about them happy for us to have the ball, and obviously it panned out in the end. But I think there were definitely phases where they were a bit rattled, and you could see the relief at the end. But at the same time, when you go, I think Warburton mentioned this after the game, when you're going for a Grand Slam, there is always one game where you either get out of jail or you have to dig deep. You look back to Wales's last Grand Slam, it was the one in Scotland, I think, was the most apparent one. You know, again, it was that slippery potential banana skin. We almost got dragged into it. It was a close run thing away at Murrayfield, and then the following week we go and do an absolute number on Ireland. And I kind of expect to see the same from the French now. You know, so I think Wales were professional and gritty and lots of that, but ultimately you're right. Other than the Jonathan Davis effort, didn't really look like scoring a try. But sometimes just being in the game is all you need. You know, it can go that way. So So I don't know. I think, you know, I've been pretty harsh, well, not harsh, but a bit critical of this side over the last couple of years. And I think you sometimes do have to take your hat off and say that there is clearly a degree of grit there. And perhaps, you know, it's a bit more grit than what I was saying before, which is dragging teams down to our level.
Yeah, exactly. I just think, tactically speaking, France were just happy. They had lots of opportunities where they could have tried to play some rugby, and they just kicked it back to us. They just would not attempt anything from their own half. And even getting up towards halfway, they were happy to put it up in the air. I was wondering if it was damper out there than it came across on TV, because France were playing like it was lashing down with rain. They're tactically, anyway. Mm. So, I mean, yeah, but as far as the positives go, I mean, the line out, the addition of Seb Davis really paid off for the line out. And the scrum, I suppose it wouldn't be a review from me if I didn't have a go at the ref. The scrum.
Six minutes, this is what the audience have been waiting for.
Yeah. They were running round, as far as I'm concerned, they were running round Tom Francis' side of the scrum. So running round the scrum to negate the threat of Tom Francis, because he is, I don't think he fully appreciated in Wales or how many penalties he wins at scrum if you scrum fairly against him.
Yeah.
Now they're running around the corner and winning penalties and free kicks for it, which was that was on the ref on Cardi. And then when Dylan Lewis came on, this is not a slight on him, but he is a far inferior scrummager to Tom Francis. Francis didn't perceive a threat from Dylan Lewis, so they weren't running around the tight end, and therefore it looked to the untrained eye, it looked like the Welsh scrum had got more steady, if you know what I mean, more secure, but it hadn't. It's just they weren't chasing around on the Thomas Francis' side and like I say, getting penalties out of Cardi out of it. So, you know, the set piece was good generally, but we just, it's been covered in various places. We just don't look like cutting people open in attack.
Yeah, we're definitely going to revisit that. I want to just look at some of the potential positives and, you know, see if we can piece them together for the longer term. I think that front five is starting to gel a bit more. And, you know, I think Will Rowlands has put in some big performances, particularly post-Dublin. And, you know, he's kind of finding his feet at international level. And then, like you say, we know how important the likes of Tom Francis are. I think Ryan Elias deserves a lot of credit for the way that he's, you know, he's come under fire for the line-out. I'm not saying that that's entirely his fault, but the line-out as a unit and him hitting his darts, you know, went really well on Friday night again. And I think at home, Wales have turned themselves into a tough side to beat. And, you know, that I think the stats and the results would back that up. So that in itself is never a bad thing. Because even under Gatland, there was, you know, God, we lost some... You know, we lost to Samoa at home at points in the same year as a Grand Slam. You know, there were some definite points where we struggled regardless of where it was. So, you know, if you build a tough side to beat at home, that is definitely worth something, particularly when it comes to the autumn internationals.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, usually we don't carry any form from the Six Nations into the autumn anyway, but you're right, if it can continue in that vein, it helps. I just think if we're going to, you know, especially away from home or even against the top, you know, say if South Africa, New Zealand or whatever come up here in the autumn, we're going to win any of those games. I think we're just going to, we're going to have to develop something in midfield, you know. People suggesting there might be changes for next week, and I just think, you know, the last time we had a free-flowing, free-scoring back on him was the 2019 Grand Slam, and that was Gareth Anscombe.
Well, so, let's stick with that, because we've had a question in from James Gwynn. It says, as good as Dan Biggar is he the best option at 10 for this team?
Well, I don't like the idea of him carrying the can for the fact the whole side can't create anything. Mm-hmm. But the combinations, you know, across not just him, but the two centres as well, they're just, I mean, not only are we not creating or scoring, there's not even line breaks to speak of, is there? You know, it's not even half breaks. It's not even, there's no threat. Like, we had the last game, Twickenham away, there was a set move that went well and sort of sparked us into life in the second half. But, and we scored three tries, albeit, you know, kind of from quickly taking penalties and things like that. Just generally across the four games, you know, there's nothing thrilling going on there, is there? So, something's got to be looked at, and if you know, if it means Biggar's got to go, but I don't think you should take it. Strictly speaking, selection is not the issue with the way we're playing. It's the general shape of our side.
Yeah,
just changing one guy won't change that.
No, well, I mean, the best attack on Friday night came from his crossfield kick. You know, where there was just a little delay on it, and then perfectly weighted kick over to Toby, and you know, again, we could spend the remaining 50 minutes of this podcast just talking about what a colossus of a man Toby Faletau is. But yeah, no, I agree. I think it's always the case, isn't it, that you immediately look at the 10. We've had this with other 10s in the past, haven't we? You know, Dan Biggar's had this a few times during his career. We've had I suppose less so. Priestland was just more about him being kind of really out of form and, you know, taking a lot of stick. And then you look back to Stephen Jones when James Hook was coming through the ranks. The tendency is always to get on the back of the 10. But I agree, I think it's bigger than that. It's a lot more about the game plan and what we're trying to do. And at the moment, for me, it feels like our best bet of winning games is to strangle the life out of sides. And, you know, it's not like I'm always guilty of looking back at the Gatland era with rose tinted specs, but it's not, you know, it's not like we were playing barbarians rugby at that point. But in those big games, you know how to execute and score tries that will win you big test matches. And I also think rugby's moved on quite a bit in the last 10 years. You know, there were the way games were refereed at certain points, you could win a game with just penalties alone. And I don't think that, you know, I don't think that's the case anymore. To beat the big test nations, you have got to get over the whitewash.
Yeah. You know, like you just covered here with Gatland, I imagine this for a while at least, being entertaining losers. Like we kind of were before Gatland in a way. Mm. You know, we swashbuckling have a go, but not really clinical enough to, you know, win a game or set piece frailties would cost us or whatever, but it hasn't worked like that at all.
It has to be a surprise, doesn't it?
There's been periods where it has, but not sustained, you know. So
when you look at the way that Pivac had success at Scarlets, you know, it was a real kind of all court offloading, turnover and run it from everywhere kind of style of rugby, and that's the bit I have found surprising. That I don't know, maybe he just thinks, looking at the players he's got around him, he's not got the personnel to be able to do that.
No, I mean, you know, you can see the broad framework of the Clenethley thing, because Faletau on the left wing, some of the forward, Seb Davis or whoever would be on the other wing, and so there is a kind of the general gist of it. But I just think I might be jumping the gun here, but the kind of silky centres they had at Scarlets at the time just aren't really silky skilled centres. The Hadley Parks and was am I getting my eras mixed up? If I say Regan King, late era Regan King,
I think there might have been a little bit of King in his second stint, but yeah, it was largely John Fox and I think. Yeah, John Fox when he came back, and then Hadley Parks, and you're right. There's someone else.
But there was always
else, I feel like we're missing someone obvious.
Yeah, but there was always on the back of that. Then there was always wingers coming into midfield. You'd stretch them. You'd stretch sides the full width with your back row forwards in the 5 meter channel, and then the wingers would come in field and look for lazy forwards, and that was basically 9/10 of the game in attack. And yeah. I'm not sure we're going to catch too many lazy forwards against France.
No,
or any of the decent international sides in midfield. You know, they're all mobile guys. Like, there's no French equivalent of, say, I don't know, I don't want to name names, but type of tight end who's a bit of a liability if he gets caught in defence, you know. So they don't tend to have those players in the good side. So I think there just needs to be more to it than what we're showing at the moment.
Yeah, which again is an interesting one, because we've had this one from this question from Paddy Gilling. It says, time to look for a new attack coach. How much do you think? How much do you think this? You know, the responsibility lies with Steve Jones, and how much of it is the players? How much of it is the kind of the overall setup? What's your thought on that, Murph?
I tend to lean towards overall setup, but I can't. I mean, it doesn't feel like a Stephen Jones backline, does it?
No, it doesn't.
I think he's struggling, or unable to, or not allowed to get out from under the shadow of Wayne when it comes to the back play. And I can't see any point in going after Stephen Jones. I mean, I think it was fairly obvious to everyone early on that Byron Hayward needed to be replaced.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you can directly identify Stephen Jones as at fault with the attacking play, even though he is the backs coach.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you get such limited time with players at international level that it almost feels like it's a fine-tuning job, that attack coach, particularly attack coach role. And, you know, I suppose because defensively you can bring in certain systems that that can have an impact quite quickly. Whereas I think, attack coach is a difficult one. But, you know, obviously Howley took a lot of stick in his time as Wales and Lions attack coach for, you know, not being expansive enough. Whether that was fair or not is a different question. But, yeah, I intend to agree with you, because I don't feel like that was a side that went out on Friday night with any real intention to play much. You know, it was about executing the kicking game and looking to go from there, and that doesn't come from the attack coach, does it? The attack coach doesn't say, well, look, you know, let's, every time we've got the ball, we do it. That's the overall game plan, which is coming from the head coach.
Yeah, and aside from anything else, I don't think in Wales 1-15 or 1-23 our handling is slick enough to have a free-flowing back line. I mean, if you look at the handling skills, the Irish team yesterday, you know, you back row forwards just take really flat, hard passes, and they don't grab them to their body either. They, you know, their hands are out in front of them, and they take them in the fingertips, and everything's just slick. And the number of times, and it obviously it transfers from the regional game, but the number of times players have to check their run because the pass is slightly behind them in this country, honestly, is a joke. Full-time professionals having to take passes just slightly behind their shoulder all the time, which takes, you know, takes away all the momentum. It gives the defence all the time in the world to work out what's going on. And you just don't see that. And obviously, it's the same in reverse with the Irish side. That's what they all play like for their region, for their provinces, should I say. So it looks like Leinster when you watch Ireland, because everything is slick and on their toes and on their fingertips.
I agree with the point about Ireland generally. I would say there were large chunks of the game where that abandoned them, with a lot going on Saturday, with a lot going to the deck and
a lot
of flat passes.
That was the surge of English pressure. They felt the injustice of someone's headbutting someone in the chin, and raised their game and just went, you know, like full Saracens mode, didn't they? And they can sustain it, but. When Ireland did get their chances, then everything looked slick. The handling looked slick, and that's why you ended up with Jack Conan scored an Adelaide try, or Caelan?
Yeah, it was Conan.
Yeah. Well, the try that I love the disallowed try that Caelan Doris scored. That was great hands across the pitch, and then Harry Randall thought he was going to tackle him. Did you see that?
That was an almighty. There's one angle which shows it. Fair play to him for getting stuck in, but it was one almighty bump.
It was Caelan Doris reminded him that he's a scrum half and I'm a number eight. Just absolutely flattened him. But anyway, it ruled out. But I still enjoyed it.
But yeah, look, I think it's a really good point around the overall skill levels when it comes to handling. And that's a difficult one because ultimately there's nothing Pivac can do in the, you know, on a 6-day turnaround to suddenly make the players be able to execute those things better. You do get the feeling that those skills are either there or they're not. And
standards need to raise, don't they? Everywhere.
They do. We've got loads more to get through, Murph. We're going to dig deeper into that Ireland game as you've just touched on there. We're going to take a load more listeners' questions and finish off on Wales, and we're going to take a look ahead to the final weekend as Wales take on Italy and the championship will be decided one way or the other. So all of that is coming up after this very quick break. Right, let's get the second half underway by taking another listener's question. We've spoken about some of the skills there, Murph, and also we've looked at the centres. This question's coming from Robert Giannotti, who I know is a long-term listener. Is it the end of the road for John Fox, or do we think he'll make it through to the next Rugby World Cup? We only took three centres in 2019, and I'm not sure he'd go ahead of North, Tompkins, Halaholo, Johnny Williams or Watkin. Not his finest game in a red jersey for Wales, was it, John Fox? And it's a tricky one. Personally, I don't think playing him at 12 helps massively.
I agree with the question. I just think he's quite the big knee injuries or reconstructions or whatever else he's done caught up with him mobility wise, and he's already, I think, showing signs of. I physically not up to it anymore, and we still got close to 18 months, not quite 18 months, I don't suppose, to the World Cup, and I suppose he could recover some of his agility in that time, but time's not going to, age is not on his side at all, so if it would be a bad sign if we have to take him, put it that way.
Based on the current incarnation of him that we've got, it looks like, and there are very few people who love him as much as I do, but it does look like he's not the same player right now, and it feels like the injuries have really taken their toll because there's been a string of horrible injuries in there.
Well, he's played on through big knee problems in World Cup semi-finals, and that's not going to help. Important to remember, and this is one of my favourite bugbears with our sport, is that he's only playing because Nick Tompkins is concussed from playing for his club on the gap week.
Yep.
Otherwise, we know full well Pivac would have picked Tompkins. He's at the kind of start of his international career, and John Davis is at the end. So there's no doubt he would have picked him. And so criticism of the selection or of John himself is misplaced in a way because he needn't have been there.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, again, I said to you before we came on air, we might end up talking a little bit about the Scarlets and Cardiff games, which... Again, just highlights the lunacy of the game at the moment. That on the day that Wales are playing at home to France in a Six Nations international, a couple of hours before, you've got one of the club sides, the other side of the world, playing in a bloody empty stadium with their reserve team against a side from South Africa in a league fixture. I know, obviously, the COVID stuff has had a big impact on that, but it's just. Whenever these things happen, it just makes the sport look even more bizarre than it should do.
Yeah, I'm not totally against the clubs playing on. I mean, the English clubs have done it for years. I'm not against the regional sides playing on the weekend. The Wales are playing. so long as they're able to field side, you know, in the gap week, they're only getting players that are allowed to play for them. Whereas Tompkins' club was insisting that he was released because he's not playing in this country, and whatever. And I think you just, if you take out all the international days, which is not just Six Nations, but the Autumn International, then it's really hard for the clubs to complete their fixtures if they don't play on at least some of them.
It's because there's too many of them, Murph. That's why. There's just too many. If you've got a league with 16 bloody sides in there,
well,
and doubling up with derby games and whatever, which I understand the commercial reasons behind it. But if you're going to do that, you're going to end up with too many games and not enough weekends, which is why, you know, this has always taken place. And I think it hinders the game. It just undermines it. Like I said before, try and explain it to a football fan that you've got games going on the same weekend as internationals. Mm. You know, like a Premier League side, if they were without, not even a Premier League side, if a League One side was without three players because of internationals, they wouldn't play the game. Rather than going, oh, well, actually, we've got 24 players unavailable because they're playing with respective international sides, it makes a joke of whatever competition you're playing in. I know your point is very different, but that's my bugbear with the whole thing. It's
slightly different than soccer, though, because they tend to do a two-game international window, which will be like a midweek game and a weekend game, and then 5 days later they're back on the pitch with their club in a league match. You know, they don't really get the recovery time that you kind of need in rugby union. So you're right, though. What I will say, though, in its defence, is I've the Scarlets game and the Blues game, I really enjoyed the style of rugby that was being played, because they were playing basically in summertime down there. The South Africans, even the weakest side out there, they're always looking to play rugby. There's no grinding out against Edinburgh on a piss wet Friday night kind of stuff, is it? And the other thing I found refreshing in watching the both games was the South African sides don't accept contact if you're on top of them. They're always fighting right to the last. They're not. Yeah. Whereas our boys will just kind of trundle into contact and then try and do a leg drive and then get to the ground. But they're always trying to throw people off and shrug people off right to the last second that they're brought to the ground. So I've enjoyed the games just on the style of play alone, you know, from our sides as well, because they're having to play rugby as well. Whereas they would, if they were playing on Friday night in a home fixture against anyone, they wouldn't have been playing like that.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. I to be honest, I just don't think I can get over the expression "grind out against Edinburgh on a piss wet Friday night." It feels like one of them. You should, we were talking about
sums
the marketing
up the UFC,
clubs. You should stick it on the poster. You know, can the boys grind out against Edinburgh on a piss wet Friday night? Tickets available online. You know,
like my club did yesterday. Actually, grounded out till piss wet Saturday afternoon against Bedwas. I was chuffed with that.
Excellent, big result. It was. Yeah, let's bring it back to Wales for the moment. And actually, you touched on Nick Tompkins there. We had this message in from Diego von Albatross. Is it all right to admit that we missed Nick Tompkins?
I think it is. You know, I think it is. It's just a lot of energy, isn't he? I mean, we've covered the issues with him. He doesn't look like he can play with anyone alongside anyone or put anyone else in space or that kind of stuff, but he just it's a kind of randomness to his movement which people can't read. So I think we probably did. It's just energy as well, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Look, and actually, to be fair to him, he's in a really good vein of form, isn't he? You know, he's playing very well for his club, and you know, it looked I think it's absolutely all right to say that. You know, like I said before, you know, we're sat here as a pair of fans talking about this. Essentially, this is a chat that should be going on
in the pub.
Yeah, you know,
listening. Even the barmaid wouldn't fucking listen.
Exactly. She's like, come on, lads, I got this. It says ringing last orders early in order to get us out of there.
Tell me off my language.
Exactly, but in a way, that's. that's kind of the beauty of it, is it's like, I'm not pretending to be some great analyst when it comes to, you know, Nick Tompkins' defensive plays or something. It's just, I don't know, there's something I just can't warm to for some reason. But there's no doubt in his performances have been very good in the Six Nations. It's just a question of, you know, whether or not that's, like Dan said a few weeks ago, whether or not we can build a back line around that. But there was very little creativity on display from anyone else in the back line. So, you know, who knows, actually, he might have made a big difference, because he is that. Sometimes, you know, it feels like he's just running down blind alleys, and other times that can be exactly it. In a world of defensive plays and very pre-prescribed playbooks, someone who takes a bit of a chance and goes off on a wild goose chase can end up getting over the line.
Well, you know, there is some logic around that, because further to Yestin's point about or his theory about the coaches are trying to get the backs to play off the cuff and just read what's in front of them, I think it goes deeper than that, because if you've got a set way of playing from phase rugby, the analysis that goes in by the opposition now, if you came up with a way of doing a certain way of playing off phase rugby, they would, within two games, everyone, all your opposition would know it, and you'd be getting swallowed up, and they'd have adapted their defence to neutralise it. So in a way, you can't, a lot of the sides, us in particular, can't play to a set structure behind. It's just, there's got to be some kind of random nature to it, and off the cuff. And like the way Ireland, in this tournament, they're my favourite backs to watch in phase play. What they do is they've got the shape behind means that Sexton or whoever is carrying the ball has got three or four options. Obviously, you know, there's kind of two runners on different angles, and then there's out the back to carry on going wide and that kind of thing. And ours just seems to be everyone on the same line. Everyone's on the crash ball line, and there's fuck all else. There's fuck all alternative, and that means we're really easy to defend against. And I think that was the root of why France were happy for us to have the ball. But if you try and put anything prescriptive in place where we're kind of doing the same thing too much, you just get analysed to death in modern rugby. So, there's a reason why international rugby is hard, and that's one of them.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. I think, it just doesn't feel, it doesn't feel like there's a huge amount of exciting stuff there. But I mean, to go on to Ireland, we know that they've got bags of aside from 10, where they're still over reliant on Sexton. And actually, to be fair, you know, Carberry putting a good performance against France, but you know, they're still terrified of doing anything without Sexton. But the rest of the back line, they've got loads and loads of options on. You know, so who's it? Lowry scored scored two tries against Italy on his debut, and then he's out with Keenan in, and Keenan had a very good game under the eye. Well, they've got those options, and you know, James Lowe, I thought, put in a really big performance at Twickenham. He gave Max Mallins a horrible time on that left flank, and they've got those options in the centre as well, where you can bring Henshaw off the bench towards the end of a big international. Which is, these are just the not luxuries. These are just the options that we don't have right now. You know, we are struggling to find out what our best 15 or best 23 is. We're chopping and changing all the time. I know injuries has had a big part to play in that.
Yeah.
But it's just a question now, as we end the tournament, are we any closer to knowing what that side is than we were when we started it?
And even when we do kind of look like we're settling on something, injury comes and gets involved, and then we're starting from scratch again. And it's not just in the centre, but for us, it's the back row changes all the time. Although you could argue the change at back row worked on Friday.
I thought that was the most balanced back row combination that we've had so far.
I mean, I agree, but I hate to admit that I agree, because I don't like second rows in the back row.
No, I don't either.
But
he had a good game, and it's the absence of us having anyone else of any great size to pick at six, I think, isn't it? You know, we've got a lot of light six sevens, and that just meant that, you know, he had to
Anything where we copy Eddie Jones is going to upset me. I suppose Ireland now and again with Tyke Byrne, we're playing at six, but I haven't done that lately. They're the only ones that have done it really. France go the other way, of course. They put their back row forwards into the second row.
Yeah.
So I prefer that. I'll go with that one.
Just ultra. I put Tame Basham in the second row.
Yeah.
Just don't even lift him. Just sling him up in the air.
Yeah.
And catch him on the way down.
One-handed. Yeah,
exactly. Let's move on then. Let's have a look at that game at Twickenham, because it was a cracker of a test match. You know, you've done a pretty good analysis of it in the I think it was in the first half there already, but
touched on it and ruined it all.
Yeah, well, clear cut red card, as clear as day, and
I mean,
I'm glad there
they
was
booed
no...
it in the stadium.
Well, yeah, I mean,
fucking hell, how could you boo? I mean, 6'12" or whatever James Ryan is, and worse than that, not only was it high, he didn't even have the ball, so it was late and high. He wasn't stooping; he had a slight flexing of his knees going on.
Mm.
He wasn't bent to the hip at all; he was completely upright. And Charlie Ewells managed to butt him in the chin or the jaw or whatever, and they booed it. Fucking.
I mean, that's
unless
they were
booing
right.
Charlie. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think he pretty. To be fair to him, he knew pretty full well, didn't he, that what had happened and
cast iron.
Yeah, it was. I mean, even Eddie Jones after the game didn't question it in the slightest. He was like, "Yeah, got it right." You know, obviously he went on to then say there should have been some yellow cards for the scrummaging, but you know, it was as clear as day that red card. And the thing I found very strange was the way that the two sides reacted. You said that England went into full on Saracens mode, which they did. Ireland, I just thought, were desperate to kill it off. And they were like, right, we're going to go and score 50 or 60 points here. And in the end, fine, you know, it was a convincing scoreboard win for them. But they just, I just thought at points, it's like, stop looking for the offload all the time. Like, you know, don't worry about it. Just go through some phases here. Don't stop getting so bloody emotional about it. And just look to go through a few phases, because they were still getting super quick ruck ball anyway. You know, the Reynal was almost letting them go full Superman. Both sides, I thought the breakdown was, you know, was pretty messy. It was would have, you know, could have been picked up by another referee for being pretty messy. But I just don't know why they felt, well, we've got to win this now. We've got to win this now before half time, and it allowed England back in the game. And they made silly mistakes and they knocked on, and then when the scrum was getting penalised that much, every time that they knocked on, it resulted in them going 40 metres back the other way down the pitch.
Yeah, and weirdly, the scoreline that it ended up on is what I thought it might be anyway, without the red card. And I think the red card galvanised England. Obviously, we just said they just went into full Saracens mode. I mean, the kick chase was superb,
yeah.
You know, even from second rows, you know, and then they would, they do that thing with every decision they get at the breakdown and every scrum decision they get, they're going nuts, and they just.
Yeah, I really don't want to see Ellis Genge's face after a penalty.
Or Jamie George.
Yeah.
His bloody big smile. Oh my god. So, but they couldn't sustain that with 14 men. And even when they, you know, Saracens play like that, they use their bench a lot, because it's intense, you know, to play that. And I just think the game was, the red card made it England and their supporters have a bit of a grudge to bear kind of thing against the world, and they just played with a chip on their shoulder and with a lot of energy, and that's what made it hard. You're right about Ireland, they didn't help themselves, but the yellow cards are scrum time. I disagreed with the referee in the scrum. If you ever see the spider cam.
Yeah, the spider cam gave it a very... I'm no expert on scrummaging, but it gave a very, very different...
Yeah. It looked like, you know, at ground level, it looked like England were going well. But if you see it on spider cam, they were all just... the English tight head was trying to scrummage onto the Irish hooker, and then each player was across, so that in effect... Across one, in a way, so that in effect...
Ellis again just scrummaging onto thin air and basically running up the side of Tadhg Furlong. Because I know I like to decree these things about props, but Ellis again just not a better scrummager than Tadhg Furlong. Mm. And I don't care what bloody Joe Mahler or not Joe Mahler, David Flatman or Adam Jones or any ex-prop says, he is not a better scrummager than Tadhg Furlong. And so they were just pulling one over on the referee there. And that's why, and I wish Wales had done it in the autumn against New Zealand. Sexton and Omani had to have a quiet word with the ref on several occasions about the way things were being refereed. When we were getting stiffed in the New Zealand game, there was barely any questioning of what was going on. So that showed a bit of experience from then. It made Reynal think more, at least, about what he was doing. And anyway, eventually, as we said, they couldn't sustain it. And Ireland were, unlike us, were able to take chances. And then you ended up with a, 20-point game or 15-point game?
Yeah, 30 points to 15 or something like that, I think. Mm. But yeah, you're right. It was interesting seeing Pierre Omani have a quiet word with the referee about England on two occasions sealing off lineouts, and then 5 minutes later, his own side gets done for exactly the same thing. But yeah. You're right. At least those things were then picked up, regardless of which side they were on. Mm. Yeah, but I mean, it was a fascinating, tense Test match. I think that I'm absolutely with you, because I'm still looking at that England back line, I'm just like, it still doesn't make any bloody sense to me whatsoever. it's almost got a touch of the Wales in the 80s. You know, how many kind of footballing outside half / centres can you chuck somewhere in this back line and kind of hope it works?
No.
But it's you're right, it definitely galvanised them. But I said this a few weeks ago, England just seemed to hit a flat spot at chunks in Test matches. They seem to hit a flat spot where they let a side completely back into it. They did it against Wales a fortnight ago. They did it against Wales in Cardiff the previous year, where they got the score back level despite two very dubious refereeing decisions, and then just completely switched off. And obviously it's much more understandable when you're down to 14 men, but there's definitely something about this. I just don't know what it is that there will become a point where they let you back into it, where you've got an opportunity to do it. And for them, it came in that last quarter against Ireland, and that's where they were able to turn the screw.
Well, they're always looking for long stoppages, aren't they? It's kind of a thing where they kind of recharge all their big forwards, although they're not actually a massive pack at the moment.
Ireland were much bigger, aren't they?
Yeah, with this current choice of prop, they're both small, especially for English props. It's not a huge pack, but they are kind of explosive, if you like. And so against us, they were always looking for stoppages. There was always someone down on the ground. There was always a bloody water boy on. There was always something going on. I wish referees would say, what are you waiting for? Get on with it. Yeah. Obviously, with injured players, you can't do that. But just seemed to break up the flow of the game for the opposition and for the spectators. So.
Yeah, it did. But I mean, the thing for me is it was a compelling Test match. And you just thought there were points in this where especially when they drew level, I was just like, surely Ireland aren't going to fuck this up. It would be just, the biggest kind of bottle job imaginable to have it after 80 seconds and then get hold of it. But what I will say is, fair play. Ireland didn't, they made some mistakes. Their game management wasn't brilliant, but they did close it out, and they didn't panic, and not just close it out. They battered them at the end and then put a good distance on it on the scoreboard.
Yeah. Much to my amusement as well, especially, the way the crowd were getting in behind, as you'd expect, by the way, but
yeah.
Just the swing low stuff, and then the cheering every single little thing, and then getting on the back of the opposition players, and like, it was nice to see them all shut up when they were getting stuffed.
The other bugbear of mine, because I actually don't think he's a bad pundit when you see him on BT, but
Delalio.
Can we please stop playing Delalio in the commentary box? Like, it's like he just cannot view it objectively as it's happening.
He can't.
He can't. Like, you know, if we're a pair of fans talking in a pub, he's just one with a bigger microphone than ours.
Yeah, weirdly, like you said, I like him on BT Sport, and you know, even when he's commentating on his old club or you know anything like that, he's fine. But he against us, he was calling infringements from us that never existed, like Alex Cuthbert knocked it on there, and you know, just weird random stuff he's coming up with, like we would in a pub, you know. He's poor. I suppose he's there as they pick him as an ex-England international, but you are supposed to be a little bit more
objective.
A little bit more neutral than that anyway. I mean, don't get me wrong, Jonathan Davis has had abuse in the past because you can hear him.
Absolutely.
You can hear him off mic.
No!
Go, off mic, you know, as someone breaks a break, a Welsh player breaks a break. But
numbers, go wide, we score.
Yeah, but there's something slightly different to it with Delalio, because he's not being excitable or doing it off mic, mic. He's actually, it's like he's running, well, the ref can't hear him, but he's like running a narrative of pro his side all the way through, just if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. The other one I find, you're absolutely right with Jiffy as well, by the way. It's just like, your job is not to be there as a cheerleader. Yes, you're there as an ex-international, so you're supposed to bring some insight into your team. You're not there to be a fan. You know, I think there is a...
Well, that's what Brian Moore was very good at.
He was very good at it. Yeah, absolutely. And it's,
he used to get more angry than he should if England were playing poorly.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he was also most of the time calling it dispassionately, if you like.
Yeah, well, I don't think that he saw things that weren't there, if you
see
what I mean.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He didn't see a 50-50 call as, oh, well, that's, you know, or even a 60-40 call as going towards England.
Imagining penalties by the opposition, stuff like that, like Delalio does. Yeah.
You're right, though. It's quite funny. For some reason, I watched back. It wasn't the whole game, but on the way to Twickenham the other week for the Wales game, I was watching the England-Wales game from 2008. Then, you know, watched a chunk of that on YouTube. And bloody hell, like, between him and Butler and whoever else they had in the box, possibly Jiffy, God, they were just moaning the whole time, man. And, you know, you look back now, and it was just such a dramatic game that... that you feel kind of lucky to have watched it, but God, they were just moaning and moaning and moaning. I don't know, they just got to stop doing it with him. And Hugo Monier on a Harlequins game, it's just like, good God, put the drum down, stop banging it for a minute.
Of the, like I say, Delalio's fine on BT Sport, but of the three they use on BT Sport, Ben Kay would probably do better than them.
I think Ben Kay is excellent, and again, he does not get dragged into those, into ever feeling like he's anything other than objective. But he very rarely gets the big games because you bring out the biggest names. That's the ITV approach, you know. Is we're one step away from having Anton Deck present the bloody studio, you know, and Holly Willoughby running up the touchline. You know, it's one step off being that. They go for the Wilkinsons and the O'Driscolls,
bloody
and
Clive Woodward,
and Clive Woodward, yeah.
And Mark Poosnatch, as my mate calls him.
Oh, God.
Might have to edit that one.
Yeah, if you were ever in doubt that this was a pub chat that no one wanted to listen to, there's your proof right there.
Look of disgust on your face was just worth it, though.
And, do you know what the thing is? I actually quite like Poosnatch as well.
Are
he's
you?
A proper broadcaster. Yeah,
I
don't
feel
mind
like
him.
I'm watching football.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. He's one of those. I like an all-rounder. I like those people who do different sports. Again, I think it just reminds me of being younger, you know, where you'd have someone, you know, Steve Ryder, he's another one. He would pop up doing that, or doing the, you know, doing the touring cars or the boat race or whatever.
They're a broadcaster.
You're a broadcaster,
What they're presented makes no difference, really.
Exactly.
Still feels like football when he's on to me.
Fair enough. Let us move back to Wales now, because another well, in my opinion, quite an unexpected and strange story is another Lazarus-like comeback from Alan Wynne-Jones. But it seems to create a little bit of debate about whether or not to pick him. We've had a couple of these questions, one from Nathan, one from Reece Knott, back into the starting 15, off the bench or neither. What do you think, Murph? I cannot for the life of me see the point in bringing him in.
No, there is no point. All you risk is more damage before he's had a chance to, you know, have a few quiet runouts first for his club. But the only argument I've heard that persuades me that it might happen was Tom Shanklin earlier on Scrum 5 said that it's his 150th Wales cap if he plays.
Right.
So just purely for the for the media side of it, there's a chance he'll be on the bench and then get on and do his 150th cap because no one's done that before. And of course, you probably don't hang around for his 150th at this stage of his career in case he gets injured again before next autumn or before the next international. So I think for that reason, they might well do it because then it's something to sell a few tickets on, turn up and see Alan Wynne-Jones have his 150th game. But otherwise,
see that from the union's perspective, you might want to do that.
Oh yeah, money.
I would hate to be the marketing executive who has to wander into Alan Wynne's dressing room and go, yeah, look, it's great, Al, but could you pitch up and do 10 minutes for us, like bloody, you know, like...
He probably wants to play. I mean, the reason he's in this position is because he probably worked really hard to get over the injury. And otherwise, you know, he wouldn't be available. So he's been with the squad this week, hasn't he? If we're hearing noises, you know, in the public about the possibility of him playing, then it's obviously gone well since he's come back.
He will play. I've no doubt. About that. You don't bring Alan Wynne-Jones into a squad to hold the tackle bags or for experience, do you?
Was thinking, you know, a bit of leadership around the place. You know, even if he doesn't get on the pitch, just his presence is enough to inspire some people. Because as we know, it's a famous thing that he trains like he plays and all that stuff. So he's going to raise standards just by being in and around without being on the pitch. But I would imagine, based on what we just said as well, I imagine he probably does make the bench next week.
Is this his 150th cap, including Lions?
According to Tom Shanklin, it's 150th Wales cap.
Is it really? Mm. Good God.
Unless he's on 149 total. But I thought he said 150th Welsh.
Again, talk amongst yourselves, Murph. It's just me, you, and the barmaid. So,
she left after I said Mark Pugacic.
Oh, don't do it again.
After I said Mark Pugacic's alternative name, she went up the lounge. God. So there's not an issue now. I can
see
it again if you like.
No, I don't want you to. 149 Wales appearances. God. That's incredible, isn't it?
So obviously no one's ever done 150 for one country. I mean, obviously, no one's got as many caps as him anyway, but it, you know, it's the first time it's ever happened. And of course, he's got, was he got nine Lions caps as well, or 10 or 12? 12, yeah. So, I mean, he's up to 161 caps now, international caps, but no one's obviously anywhere near him. McCaw was on 140 something, wasn't he, when he retired?
Like that, yeah.
So he's 150's never been done. So I imagine that'll be an extra couple of seats they can sell next week. By the way, I had this conversation many times over the weekend at my rugby club and what have you. The Friday night game meant there was over 10,000 people missing from the stadium on Friday night. And if you base that on tickets costing about £100 each, I mean, I don't know which tickets they were, but some of them are 115 quid. So this, if you average it down to close to 100 quid, that's well over £1 million worth of tickets unsold. So I don't know how the TV deal works, but if they've agreed to do a Friday night game, are they getting extra money? Are they being compensated for moving it from a Saturday? Because like we covered last week, if you live in West Wales, Mid Wales, North Wales, anywhere, not in South Wales, basically, you've got to take time off work to get to the stadium, and then you can't get home again because public transport stops about 8:30 p.m. in Wales. And so you've got to drive. Or you've got to get a hotel, which is the price is tripled in Cardiff, in case anyone doesn't know, on international weekend. So that's why they, 10,000 people plus didn't turn up. I mean, if you live local, it's not an issue at all. You can just, you know, walk down. But that is, you know, aside from what those people would have spent while they were there, that's just ticket alone is over £1 million worth of revenue gone by playing on a Friday. So,
I mean, look, regardless of what the TV does, there's no way the WRU would have expected that level of ticket sales. You know, Friday night or no Friday night, there's no doubt they would have expected to sell out against France. And
well, the point is, on a Saturday they would have. Play that 12 hours later or whatever, not 12, the 16 hours later, that would have been sold out on a Friday, on a Saturday afternoon. And they'd have been over £1 million better off, which in a cash-strapped union and sport in general in Wales, it just seems like a, like I say, maybe I'm missing, you never know, maybe we're missing something in terms of bonus advertising money from playing on a Friday night, because viewing figures are possibly bigger on a Friday night, I don't know, but it just seems like a massive own goal. From where I am, it seems like a massive own goal financially.
Yeah, and we can't afford any of them, given the horrendous times that the horrendous financial times, as well as everything else that's gone on in the last couple of years. So, yeah, that's not what we need to see. So, yeah, I mean, who knows? They'll probably wheel Alan Wynne-Jones out for every bloody game now till he gets to his 200th cap. yeah, in the hope that we can flog a few more tickets. Let's have a look ahead to next week's game, though. Let's just quickly take a look at any changes you might make, Murph. I mean, we're assuming that that Alan's going to come in. Is he going to start or on the bench? What do you think?
I don't know. I can't second guess this. I mean, no one in the country saw Seb Davis coming. I didn't even think Josh Navidi would be ready.
I'm not sure he was ready, by the way. Yeah, he was fine. He was industrious, but that wasn't a Josh Navidi.
No. Well, he looks like he's lost weight since he's been away, and that's going to take the edge off the size of your tackling and what have you. But you know, like I said, they shouldn't rush Faletau back, and they did.
So did I. And he's been blinding.
Yeah, Navidi, and they did. We never saw Seb Davis moving to six either, so I'm not going to doubt it. I mean, if there's one bloke you wouldn't doubt, it's Alan Wynne-Jones. But there's no issue with the current second row partnership. They had a great night in the lineout on Friday, and the only part you would gain there, aside from leadership with Alan Wynne-Jones, is he seems to make tackles which last about 30 seconds.
Yeah,
which means the opposition never get fast ball when Alan Wynne-Jones is in the tackle, and our defence is always set and ready. That's something they miss, you know, with him not being there. But we're playing Italy, not France. So, probably for ticket sales, they probably will pick him.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I think realistically, you'd be tempted to go with the same side again, but possibly bring Tompkins in. Yeah, that's what I'd probably be.
Yeah, Tompkins, and I'd like to see more minutes of Gareth Anscombe to see if he can get him going behind. But I mean,
I'd like to see him get more minutes at club rugby, to be honest. He's been out for so long, and then you know had fits and starts playing for the Ospreys. But I'm a big fan of his. I think he's an excellent player, but he can't be fully match ready right now.
No, but
not for international rugby.
He's looked okay in the short periods he's been on the pitch
for Wales. Yeah.
He seems to, you know, I know it's quite a cheesy thing, but he looks like he's playing with his head up. That's not always the case with our backs at the moment.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Right, elsewhere then, what do we think is going to happen in the other fixtures? Ireland, Scotland. Ireland are still chasing the championship now.
Yeah, but if the other games go to form, that is Ireland beat Scotland and France beat England, Wales get a bonus point. We can end up third or fourth, depending on you know, bonus points in other games and what have you.
Yeah.
So, and it also, more importantly, I think, England
could end up higher than England. Yeah.
England could end up fifth.
Yeah, I know. I did think that. Normally, if I'm honest with you, the league table doesn't mean jack shit to me, because it's like, unless you're first, you're almost like, unless you're first or last, anything in the middle. I know there's financial rewards, okay, which does make a difference, but you can never judge a campaign by like, oh well, we finished third or we finished second. It's like, no, you didn't win
it's
it.
It's not mega important. Like, you didn't win it. To me as a Welsh fan, but it is important from the point of view of England finishing fifth 2 years running.
Now that absolutely is huge.
And also, you know, if that was Wales, people would call for the coach to go.
Yeah.
I don't know why there's not more of it in England. The biggest, you know, only France are on a par with him in terms of participation and resources and everything going for them. And yet they underperform. I know they got probably the problems have been compounded by Tuilagi and Farrell being out for the whole tournament, and it probably would look a lot rosier if either of those were playing, but they don't perform to greater than the sum of their parts. If they did, we'd be in trouble. They'd always, I don't know, even when they, you know, obviously now and again they win a Grand Slam, but they should, the bare truth is they should be winning it regularly.
They haven't won a Grand Slam since his first season, have they?
No, I don't think so. They had a championship.
They had a championship
the following year, yeah. And by the way, same goes to France, but that's well documented, you know.
Yeah.
They've been underachieving until the last two seasons. Yeah, if he was Welsh, we're already on our we're already on our coach's back because of the style of play. They should be on his back just because they're finishing fifth regularly.
Right, quick predictions. Wales beat Italy, bonus point.
Yeah.
Wales beat Italy with a bonus point.
It's still like a frustrating late fourth try from a driven line out kind of rubbish, I would imagine.
Yeah. Penalty try. Penalty try, who wins man of the match. I'm joking. We all know Toby wins man of the match.
Yeah.
Ireland, I think, will give Scotland a hiding, if I'm honest. I know that they'll be super fired up for it.
That's Scotland, in Dublin.
Yeah, Scotland are ropey as hell on the road. And I think that they're so powerful. Superman breakdowns. And I think they'll, I think they'll be on for if they're chasing the championship, they'll need the bonus point. And I think they'll get it.
I hope it's a good game, because I've sat through a lot of really crap Ireland and Scotland games in my time.
Yeah.
6-3 games in the 90s, you know, in Lansdowne Road in a gale.
Eric Elwood's drop goal edges it.
Yeah, those kind of games. So I hope it's potentially the way Ireland play and the way Scotland try to play, it could be a good game. And I hope it's not 6-3.
I don't think it will be, but I think it's been a tough campaign for Scotland, and that's the last place you want to finish, because if Ireland had lost yesterday, they'd have had nothing to play for, and it'd have been a bit of a dead rubber because they're chasing the championship, and generally a good even if they don't win the championship, it'll be a good finish for them if the only game they've lost is to France. You know, and a triple crown as well, so you know that silver is worth something.
That's what I meant to say when you were on about where you're finishing the table. You're either, you know, winning it or no one cares, but there's the championships obviously and the Grand Slam, but the triple crown is also a thing, which the league table the league table doesn't matter in that regard, does it?
No, exactly. And the league table matters if you're playing a 14 team season. You know, that's a good gauge. You can't gauge it on five games, I don't think.
No. Yeah.
I think England, freshly buoyed from their us against the world exploits against Ireland, I think will get beaten quite, not heavily, but I think it'll be a convincing win for France. I think there's too much on the line and they're too good a side for them not to.
Yeah. Like I say, I think England overperformed yesterday because of the red card. And there might be a dose of reality on next week against France, and if it, I mean, if it goes as if France play to their potential, you know, play, say if they turn up their best performance of the championship so far, there'd be a lot of pressure on, there'd be a lot of nerves, obviously because they've gone for the Grand Slam, but they turn out their best performance of the championship so far, it could be really ugly for England, and it could genuinely be people after Eddie Jones, after if they get, if they, you know, say if they, I don't know, they lost by 15 ish to Ireland, say if they lose by 20, 20 plus to France, there is, you know, there's already people in the media, like Clive Woodward, for example, who's not keen on some of Eddie's selections. Mm. But and Matt Dawson has been having a moan this weekend, and various people are, you know, over the season.
The times are always quick to get the knives out for an England coach. Stephen Jones in the Times will be baying for blood.
Well, I think he's had much more patience from the media than I know he's been generally successful, but since the World Cup, they've been underperforming. That's 3 years ago, nearly. So I think he's had much more patience from the media than some of his predecessors, like, I don't know. It was difficult. Say Martin Johnson's stint, he was taking over a World Cup winning side, in effect. Not directly, but within this couple of seasons to win the World Cup. And then a World Cup final appearance in 2007 as well, on the back of a poor tournament kind of thing. So there was the expectation hanging over him. And of course...
Yeah, from a coach who'd never coached a side before or after.
Yeah, well, yeah. But you know, what I mean is Eddie Jones came in, did well with a side that had been humbled in their own World Cup under Stuart Lancaster. So I think he's gone just as pear-shaped as other coaches who have been sacked, or who would have been sacked by this stage already, if that makes any sense. Ashton was the other guy as well, wasn't it? Since
Brian Ashton, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, they didn't get much leeway. Not like Andy Jones is getting.
No, well, yeah. I mean, Brian Ashton picked up that side and that World Cup stint, and then he was gone within a season of that, wasn't he? And Martin Johnson was in. So probably rightly, but. Rightly in terms of, I don't think Ashton was the right choice, but we can revisit England coaching appointments from 2008 on a Patreon special. But for this week, I think that does us nicely, Murph. If you've enjoyed listening to this one in the pub with us or otherwise, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks as always to our sponsors at So Coffee Trades. Go on, Murph, do the line.
I was going to say Mark Pugach, no, but I won't. Oh, in front of the barmaid. Caffeine, not nicotine, kids.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sure this is exactly what people are tuning in for.
you're editing. You're going to be editing all night.
No, yeah. if you'd only mentioned it once, I'd have edited it out. But I'm
The other times I said his name the right way round.
Yeah, well, fortunately for any listeners, I'm far too lazy to do that, and I'm sure they'll have enjoyed your pub chat. But yeah, thanks for listening. We'll be back to chat rugby with you next week.
Sports Social Podcast Network.